to Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I got to tell you something, people. This is a new millennium. I recorded show 1000, so it's a brand new start. It's a brand new slate, and I'm going to be having some past guests on. And we're, of course, getting new guests. And my guest today, it's funny, that's actually him playing drums. I asked him to do me a song, and he did it. And, of course, he has his voiceover voice, you know. And I was looking at my records, because he's been involved in some of my other business adventures, you know, my show, The Coop Tang, and stuff like that. But he has not been on Cooper Talk since 2016. And I looked it up. He did it in January of 2016 in studio in Burbank. And he did it in October of 2016 when I was doing it out of my place in Burbank. And it's just funny. Time flies. And my guest is Rich Redmond. What's up, Rich?
What's up, partner? Good to see you, man.
I was looking, and I'm like, when did Rich do it? So I went to my Google it, Rich Redmond on Cooper Talk, and the January came up, because if you don't know, people, I met Rich, Lucky Lara from the Circle Jerks had this great party. He had this mansion in the hills, and I went, and I said, hey, I'm always out scouting for guests, and he said, you know, Rich, and he plays for Jason Aldean. Well, at the time, I didn't know who Jason Aldean was, even though he's like the biggest country star. I just didn't follow country, so I think it was easier for me to talk to Rich, because I wasn't coming like, oh yeah, you work for Jason Aldean, you know, you work with him. And we hit it off, and I remember he came into the studio, because I had a cancellation, and he had a really nice leather jacket on, and it was raining. And do you remember that? That was a while ago. That was a nice leather.
You got to break it in, man. Can you believe that's going to be 8 years or so?
Over 8 years.
Yeah, you're always having me on your show, man. I really appreciate it. And to be in the new millennium, what am I? 1001, A Space Odyssey?
You're 1001, and it's funny. You look back, and you know, because you podcast, and you, how many episodes do you have now?
172 or 173.
Okay. But you're a busy guy. You're on the road. But
well, you know, in the early days, you know, I've been doing it for maybe 4.5 years or something, which is unbelievable. But we were committing to do two a week, and we did that for about a year or two. And then, you know, sometimes things get busy, and then you're down to one episode. And then I wrote a book last year, and that took a year of my life. So the podcast took a backseat, and now I'm committing to 52 episodes this year, one a week.
Well, you know, it's good. We were in a pandemic, too. So it was easier for you to do those episodes when you're in a pandemic, because you weren't out on the road. And but with your show, what's funny is, well, because I've done so many shows, I forget guests I have. Like, do you remember every guest? Like, I sat there and I was watching TV, and the guy, Mark Ralston from Shawshank Redemption, I was like, oh, my God, he was on my show. And so it's funny. You'll get to that point because you start forgetting, and then because there's so much stuff going on in life. But now tell me more about the book. You said, you know, is this your second book? You were doing so much shit.
Book, yeah. Yeah, man, no, it's so the first book I wrote was called Fundamentals of Drumming for Kids. Get it? You want drumming to be fun. And that's, you know, for kids, that young kids that want to learn how to play the drums. And it's great for kids, like, you know, ages 5 to 50-year-old men that act like 5 years old that want to learn how to play the drums. And so that was good. That's nice to have out there. That'll be, you know, out there forever. And then I wrote kind of like a half memoir, half motivational book, because, like, you know, I do a lot of corporate and inspirational motivational speaking. And, you know, my whole kind of takeaway and platform for doing that is the concept called CRASH, and CRASH stands for commitment, relationships, attitude, skill, and hunger. Anybody in any season of their life can use it to enjoy more professional and personal success. So I wrote that book, and, you know, if you subscribe to Audible, it's one of the free offerings, and I did the read myself, which was really fun. And then this third book is called Making It in Country Music, An Insider's Look at the Industry. It's basically like kind of eviscerates the how everything works in Nashville, the web of life. And, you know, if you want to move to Nashville, be part of this crazy industry, you know, I let people know it's not just the guy or gal with the hat out front. There's this whole ecosystem of people either playing musical instruments or setting up the musical instruments, or road managers or photographers or social media managers or chefs or truck drivers. It's like all these people are needed to make this whole kind of thing work. And that came out from Roman and Littlefield. They're a great press, and I guess they really loved the book and believed in us because they gave us a hardback, you know. So it's my first hardback book. So that's out there in the world, and we're happy that it's out there. You know, books are business cards. Books give you the permission to have notoriety, be an expert on a subject, get to be on fun podcasts like this, do speeches. The only person that's really crushing it with books is Stephen King. Let's face it.
Well, you know, the thing about books, though, which you mentioned, is it is a calling card. Because I know people, I know a lot of public speakers back here, and when they have a book, they build that into the price of the event. So it's like, pay, you know, if it's a, they're doing an event, pay this for a chamber of commerce or something and get the book. And it's funny when you talk about the book, about making it. And it's just so funny we're talking today, because I was at a networking event this morning, this coffee place, and I met this girl who's doing real estate now. And her husband and her own ice cream shop. They're working on that. But she's a violinist, and she's played with The Who. She's been a violinist for a whole time. And she said to me, and now that you say about your book, it's so pertinent. She said, the thing I wished when I went to the music school is, and I talk to actors the same, I wish they told me what to do when I get out. Because you sit there and you go and you learn the scales, or for you, you know, I know you were the drumming, you learn that. But when you get out, and just like actors, you learn how to do a monologue. But when you get out, people go,
yeah, good luck.
Yeah, get an agent. Well, how do I do that? Well, you don't know. So what made you decide? Because I know why you wrote Crash, because, you know, you're speaking. I want to get to that. But what made you decide to write this? I know you're very, in the old, I hate the term, Everett, several years, you're a very go-giver. You are a go-giver. You give. I know people, you tweet back to people. You know, our friend TJ Smink, people, is a gentleman. I know a young guy who had cancer. Rich met him, and he ended up going and meeting Rich at a show. So Rich is like that. But what was the reason why you sat down and wrote this latest book? Was it just because you thought that old saying, I wish I knew? I mean, why did you decide to write it? Because a book is a hard process.
Yeah, it's a long process. You know, it was 50-something years in the making, and it took a year to kind of write. The seeds were kind of like germinating about 7 years ago. I had another co-author, my friend Michael Albrecht. He's kind of an expert on the Civil War, and he's written so many books on the Civil War, and he actually helped me write that first book because his son was learning drums, and he's like, there's not a lot of great beginner drum books out there. I was like, well, let's write one. You know, I have the expertise, and you know how to get a product over the finish line. So let's do it together. So I'm all about the teamwork. So this particular project, I know this amazing editor and author. Her name is Jennifer Delazana, and she got us the publishing deal. And I was like, you know what? You got us the publishing deal. Now we're locked in. We got to do this thing. So let's get it out there. But, you know, I have all this experience in this crazy business where there really are no rules. There's no exact science. There's no path that leads you to get to success in this business. First of all, you have to define that success. And many times, you have the skill set. That's where kids learn in college, or they grew up, you know, doing their tens and tens of thousands of hours to get their skill set together. But then they have to go to a New York or a Los Angeles or a Nashville and try to figure out how to jump into that deep end of the pool and make this thing happen. And I somehow have pulled this off just from the, you know, the sweat of my brow and ultra tenacity and persistence and having a laser focus and falling in love with the word no. And you just do it. And so I was like, okay, so I have a little authority on the subject. I lived it. Let's put this down in writing. It'll be around forever, kind of like Donald Passman's, you know, This Business of Music, which is a very popular book that's been around for decades. And if it can save people 5 years on their journey, 5 minutes on their journey, anything, hopefully they're going to take something away from the book, because they can experience my victories and the hardships through my eyes, and maybe they can glean something from that and just kind of help their journey.
So what was your process for writing it? Because, you know, like for me, if I have a comedy show, I'll sit there and I like to do new stuff, and shit just pops in my head. I can't sit down and write. I just can't. I mean, even like I have an idea for this TV thing or possibly a movie. It's all in my head, and I can't sit down and write. But for you, you had the deadline. Okay, you have to do it now. You have a deal. It's not like, oh, I'm self-publishing when I get to. You had to do it, and you probably had them saying, where's the pages? But did you sit down every day to write it? Because you have all these stories, and I think also because you're creative, that as you're going through these stories, like, okay, moving to Nashville, you're thinking, oh, shit, I should be putting this. I mean, was that going to, because you have such a wealth of knowledge that you, when you're writing a book and not just writing a journal, you have to edit in your head, else you're going to show these people like 800 pages that are going to go, what the fuck is this? You know, so what was your writing process to get this book done? Were you sitting down each day, or what happened?
I mean, some of this material was inspired by this writing process from 7 years ago. Some of it was inspired by articles I've written for other magazines, you know, like Modern Drummer Magazine or Drum Magazine or Percussive Notes. You know, I do a lot of writing for these professional publications. And then the beauty of having a co-author is that they help you get out of your head and get across the finish line and see that 50,000-foot view of things. So I would have conversations via Zoom with Jennifer, and we would start formulating things, and she would write, and I would write, and then when she would write, I'd have to rewrite to put it in my voice so it for sure sounded like me. So there's this back-and-forth process, and then the beauty of having the podcast, great timing, is that Jennifer went back and watched 150 podcast episodes and was able to pull things out, like cool quotes, and we were able to incorporate my guests over the years into the book. And then you get a working draft, and then it's writing and rewriting and writing and rewriting. And then several times toward the end of the process, I read the book out loud to her, and there's something about the words coming out of your face that is the finalization process to make sure that it's smooth, it reads well, there's a conversational tone, it sounds like myself. So many things, you know, like coming up with the cover image, coming up with the cover photo, picking all the photos in the book, getting permission to use the photos, getting permission to use the quotes. Don't even get me started on the index and the glossary and the bibliography. That's like the fact that Jennifer is like a professional editor and she deals and teaches writing on the college and professional level. You know, I had somebody that would do the footnotes and stuff. And to me, that is like boring. I would rather not do the book than do that. And that's why it's so great to have a partner to help you get across the finish line. I know I've said that a million times, but it is just a thing. Everybody brings their individual skill sets to the table. So I had enough notoriety that people would want to maybe hear what I have to say. And she had the know-how, experience, and technical knowledge to put it into an incredible format. And then, of course, you have to work with the editor from the publishing company as well. So it's a very long process. So the fact that we did it in under one year, pretty good.
Now, at any time when you were writing it, and you can be honest, and maybe it didn't happen, but at any time that you were working on this and writing, did you ever go through your mind just saying, no one's going to want to read this? This sucks. Because we all do that. You know, you can sit there. I'm sure when you work, you know, you're performing with Jason and the place is going crazy, you probably sit there and go, oh, shit, I hit that symbol wrong. Or like a comic, we can do a 30-minute set and one joke doesn't work, and we walk off going, "Well, yeah." But was there any time that
was
there any time that you looked at it and you said, "I don't know, man. Just maybe, you know, maybe it's a part of imposter syndrome. I don't know." But did you ever sit there and go, "Maybe this just, man, no one's going to read this." Did that go through your mind at all?
I knew there's always an audience, you know what I mean? Especially you get to the point where it's like, oh my God, you know, I can go into the grocery store and hear myself, a couple times, or in the elevator a couple times an hour, or on the radio. So it's like, oh my God, this is cool. I left a little legacy behind, a little sonic legacy. So I knew that there would be an audience out there. Like I said, not a Stephen King audience, because people want to know about, is Cujo going to eat the woman? You know what I mean? It's very, very, you know, this is more of a technical, it falls into the how-to. You know, it's not going to be in every bookstore. And that, you know, but no, that, you know, occasionally there's doubt, like, yeah, oh my God, this is a lot of work for, I don't want to do this anymore. But that's what the beautiful of having somebody else who can talk you off the ledge, you know, and then deadlines. You know, I think Leonard Bernstein said, like, you know, how do you, you know, get across the finish line? Oh, you have to have not enough of a plan and not enough time. You know what I mean? That's the thing, is not having enough time. That will really make you hyper focus. Yeah, like I said, hopefully this, you know, helps people. And then when the book comes out, you know, you throw your little parties. It's not like doing press junkets is a thing, because most publishers, sometimes they have an in-house publicist, but really it's like they publish the book, but then it's really on you to go after new media, try to lock down podcasts, do the morning television shows, you know, Today in Nashville, like I did Today in Florida, you know, Today in Jacksonville. You do those morning music new zines, and you do everything you can, but that's a full-time job, making sure that every library, public school library, prison library, music business program in the United States has this book. I don't have the time. And so to get somebody to do that, you know, you have to pay. And are you going to get an ROI on your investment? You know, it's so my concept on all the books is like, release them to the wild, and then the people that are supposed to find them, find them. You know,
now your books about, you know, making it in country music and all that. Now tell me, You got to Nashville, what, 22 years ago? You got to Nashville?
Yeah, 1997, 25, 26 years.
Okay. I want you to tell me, and you can go into detail, how it's changed. Because, you know, like L.A., I was in L.A. for a long time, and now I find out where Burbank, which was so nice, now there's a lot of homeless. It's not, you know, it's not the rents, you know, it's there's traffic. Like, L.A. has changed a lot. But when you, what was Nashville like when you first moved? You said 96, that's 28 years ago. What was it like? Because back then, country music is not where, back then, where it is now. Like, you know, like you with Jason, you know, Jason, you know, when I saw you guys, it's almost like Southern rock. I mean, in all honesty, some of the songs, you're like, oh, you can relate to it. But back then we had, especially us East Coasters had that mentality, because my ex-wife's father was a redneck, and he's like, oh, he tried to sing. I'm like, that was that shit. You're not in a country? No. But what was Nashville like when you first moved there, as I said, 28 years ago?
Yeah, like, well, I'm trying to think, 1997. I think that's, my God, what is that, 20-something? Long time. This kid from Connecticut playing country and Western music. You know, it's like, I just knew that I wanted to go to New York, L.A., or Nashville. I got some opportunities in Nashville, some cool auditions with people like Tina Carter, Barbara Mandrell, Trisha Yearwood. Everybody in the band, you know, I was flying in from Dallas. They had great things to say about me. I was like, well, you know, no one knows me in New York or Los Angeles, and there's a bunch of people that are reacting positively to my musicianship. So I gave my band 2 weeks' notice in Dallas. I come to Nashville, and it was very different. It's essentially a little big town. That's where that band got their name, in the sense that it's a small town with big city opportunities. But that was the height of, I don't know what to call it, the height. There was like the height of 90s country was probably 90 to 94. And I got there in 97 and things had started to take a dip in popularity. But then next thing you know, Shania's out and the drums are getting turned up in the mix. And, you know, it's this storytelling about all what happens in the heartland between New York and L.A. Very popular. But it was just a little bit more of a one-horse town. We didn't have valet parking and gigantic parking structures and tall and skinnies everywhere and $700,000 starter homes. We had hot dog stands, souvenir shops. We had, like, three streets that the entire music business was on. Now the tentacles have gone out, and there's all sorts of areas of town where people are creating music. I mean, right now, someone is trying to write the next Jason Aldean, Tim McGraw, Miranda Lambert hit, and then there's a whole ecosystem of people around that that is used to bring that song to life. And they're all equally important, because if one of those people in the cogs in the wheel doesn't do their job, then the song doesn't make it to radio, and then the soccer moms can't drum along with on the steering wheel. So it was very different. It was a smaller industry, and I think there was a smaller group of people that were doing a lot of the work. You know what I mean? There was like these, it's, I don't want to call it a good old boy system, but it was definitely like you get into the mix and it's very hard to break into that thing. So the best way to navigate through that was to create your own group of people that can climb the ladder together, as opposed to a 27-year-old kid trying to break in with a group of 50-something musicians that are playing on every song in town. So that's exactly what I did. I met a core group of guys. We met a young Jason Aldean. We built something. And then along the way, you know, 32 number one songs. The guy can sing a AC/DC down the middle rocker, something very southern rock, something three chords in the truth, traditional country, a wedding type song, a hip hop, you know, where he's rapping. He's all over the place. A Motown and R&B inspired thing. There's very few artists that have that kind of range and the popularity of having a male and female audience 15 to 55. That is also very rare. So I count my stars every day that pretty early in my Nashville journey, I met the guys in our band and a young Jason Aldean. And so, yeah, now we have, like I said, tall and skinnies, very expensive, a lot more traffic, takes longer to get places. It's just one of the hot cities, and that's what happens. They overbuild, and historical buildings come crumbling to the ground, and there's just a lot of change.
Do you think people will start leaving there? Like, I interviewed, as I said, I interviewed Mick Mars, and he lives in Nashville. And, you know, a lot of these metal, your friend Ray Lazier, he lives in Nashville, I believe. A lot
played
of people,
on the drum, played drums, yeah.
And he played on Mick's album. And a lot of people left L.A. to go to Nashville for the reason you said. It wasn't L.A. It wasn't overpriced housing. It was like, oh, our kids can get raised somewhere. Do you think 5, 10 years from now, people will be start leaving Nashville and find it. Now, I won't go to Austin because Austin's already overpriced and it's a hipster doofus area. But do you think there'll be a time where people are going to sit there and say, not you, because you've been there for a long time, but like anything, people used to come to L.A., be there for 5 years and leave. But now they're staying because you can't afford to move anymore. It's just this way it is. Do you think in down the road, people will start leaving Nashville because they know they can record, like you have a studio in your house. We can record in the studio, but we don't need Nashville for the business. Do you think that will happen, or is that just something that Nashville just has too much history that people will just always stay there?
I think they'll always are going to come flocking here, and maybe the numbers will go up or the numbers will go down a little bit, but it is truly one of the last places for the music business because, you know, New York is all about, like, you can maybe get a Broadway show, which is a nice union show, and you live in Staten Island or Connecticut, and you got to take the train in every day, and it's a whole thing. Or you're in a wedding band or a corporate band that plays the tri-state area. Maybe you're lucky and you have the house band. You're the drummer in Saturday Night Live. You know, he's had that job for over 25 years. And then in Los Angeles, you know, you've got the big Marvel films and there's like a full orchestra if you're lucky enough to get into that zone. But the housing, like I said, is so crazy. 1.2 million to be out in Sun Valley, you know, with bars on your windows, it's kind of tough. And then so people are coming to Nashville. People still talk about Austin, Texas, but Austin, Texas is fantastic. There's a lot of history there and they call it the live music capital of the world, but the infrastructure isn't there. They don't have as many bus companies and studios and rehearsal facilities. And it's just, it pales in comparison to the infrastructure that Nashville has. And so I think that if you're coming for the music business, you're always going to be coming to Nashville. And as far as like, well, I can live in, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, and still record with people from my home. Yes, but then how are you going to cultivate the relationships for you to get clients that are going to hire you to use your studio? That comes from being in the mix, in the watering hole, being able to run into people at showcases and award ceremonies and all that kind of stuff. There's something just about you must be present to win. So I don't see it changing unless some other musical center becomes an epicenter. And there are those places like your Austin, Atlanta, Portland, Seattle, all kind of, you know, Dallas, Texas has a robust music scene, Phoenix. They're still tertiary markets. People are always going to come to Nashville because it's the songwriting capital of the world. It's still more affordable than the coasts, and it is got a southern charm to it. It's pretty easy to meet people. And I don't think it's going to change, man. I think the prices are going to keep going up.
Now, as I said, you've been around, a working musician for a long time. Do you remember the first time you were in the studio with a big star? Like the first time, because, you know, I always ask actors that and they go, you know, we come from our background on theater. All of a sudden, actually, it was Terry Serpico, who was on Army Wives and Fear Things. His first movie part, he's in a scene in Donnie Brasco with Pacino and Depp. This is his first major part. And of course, he's shitting himself because, of course, but he got his last name Serpico and Pacino played Serpico. So there was a little thing. But do you remember the first time you had to sit in the studio with someone big, you know, you probably could, and were you nervous? Can you remember that time?
Early on, my first marquee job, 2 years into my national journey, was with a gal named Pam Tillis, Mel Tillis's daughter, and she had like a great run as kind of like a 90s pop country starlet. Very nice lady, kind of really championed me, really enjoyed having me in the band. I really liked working with her. It was the first time I ever got to experience playing live shows where everybody in the audience knew every word to someone's song, and it was their music. It wasn't like I was in the Dallas clubs playing Janet Jackson and Coolio, you know, learning two new pop songs every week. I was playing with her, and I was emulating these great session drummers, Eddie Bears and Lonnie Wilson, that I had been emulating and kind of looking up to, and then now became my friends and have been on my podcast, and, you know, we can have a cocktail a couple times a year. Crazy. But she hired me to start playing percussion on some of her records. And it was cool because I was already in her band. And then along the way, I met a guy named Tim Rushlow, who was the former lead singer of Little Texas. And we were in a band called Rushlow. We had two soft hits out on Lyric Street Records. We were kind of like a Rascal Flatts light kind of a vibe. And we took that same rhythm section and we're working with Jason. And Jason was a super cool guy. And because of my relationship with Jason, you know, you get to meet the Bob Segers and the Brian Adamses and the Ludacrises, and then you meet all his friends, and you're like, oh, now I'm playing on a song with Eric Church, and there's Luke Bryan. Oh, Keith Urban's going to play a guitar solo. It's on the CMT Awards. And then your just circle just starts to grow. It was all because of that initial relationship with Jason, but I don't usually get starstruck. I tell my students, I say, remember, celebrities poop and pay taxes, and that's what's going to ground you, because they really are no different. They're just people that had a vision, they had a focus, they had a dream, they followed it through, and hopefully when they get there, they're happy, they're secure people, and they treat people well. And 9 times out of 10, I work with people that are very respectful. I mean, when we did the Crossroads special with Bob Seger, he came in, he knew all of our music, he knew our names. I mean, when Bob Seger, he's a billionaire, he walks in and shakes your hand and says, what's going on, Rich? It's cool, you know what I mean? It's just very nice, you know. So yeah, they poop and pay taxes, man.
I got a drumming question for you.
Yeah.
Okay. 3 songs. Which would you rather drum to? This is a rock question.
Rock and roll.
Fat Bottom Girls by Queen, Tom Sawyer by Rush, or Money for Nothing by Dire Straits. Which one would you rather drum to? Because they all have that great, like, Fat Bottom, and they all have a great, as a drummer, I'd be sitting there going, boing, you know, oh, that's awesome. Which one would, if someone said pick one, Rich, what would you do?
I like Fat Bottom Girls because Roger Taylor had this kind of like, he was such a great musician and just like a huge sound, huge drums, huge cymbals, big hair, always really super stylish. And he just had this kind of like swagger to him. And there's just there's a lot less notes, man. I mean, Tom Sawyer, you gotta have a lot of drums. Play Fat Bottom Girls, you can probably get away with it in like smaller kit, like a Ringo kit, bass drum, snare drum, 2 toms, which is kind of where I live. If you ever come see us play live, I stay in that Ringo zone of kick, snare, 3 toms, which is kind of like the Bonham thing, and then, you know, a China cymbal, a cowbell, and then some sort of electronics thing, because all the crazy kids got to have their little electronics thing on the side. But I'm never a guy that has tons of toms. You know, it's just, I'm not that kind of drummer. And when I do tributes, I've done tons of tributes here in Nashville with these great groups of people for like an Alex Van Halen tribute or a Rush tribute or a Stuart Copeland. And it's like, if ever I have to do like super fast drum to drum stuff, which is what I had to do with a Neil Peart thing, you really got to practice it because you really get into accuracy. You know, you've really got to go drum to drum quickly. And a lot of times you don't get to see the kit that you're going to play on the tribute until you maybe run the song one time. And then boom, you got to go do the show. And you just got to go, here we go. And you just tighten up your butt cheeks and go, you know what I mean?
Now, I got a question. I know you did the Bonham Bash. How does that mean something to you? Because you were like the only country drummer there. But do those shows, when someone asks you, I mean, you, as I said, you've had a great career, but does it still mean something? Because it's like, you know, it's not like Jets versus Sharks, West Side Story, but it's, you know, rock and drummers, country drummers, and people don't sit there and go, people go, hey, Neil Peart, as you said, or hey, Stukum. People never go like, hey, such and such, because they don't know. But does something that means something to you, that getting accepted by your peers, does that mean a lot to you?
Totally. I think I've done 3 or 4 Bonzo Bashes. It was created by our friend Brian Tishy. Brian Tishy, fantastic drummer. God, he's played in Whitesnake and Dokken and Foreigner. He's just a Billy Idol. He's a great go-to Angelino drummer that usually has some sort of a great rock job. And from taking an initiative and going out to Los Angeles for like a 12-year period and really, really aggressively for 5 or 6 years and being bi-coastal for some of that, I was able to meet a lot of these guys. And then they get to see your playing and they get to know you like you trust you, you know, which is a great, you know, business concept. People want to work with people they know, they like, and they trust. And Brian was like, I'd love for you to do this. And yeah, for very many years, I was the only guy from Nashville represented on that roster. And I'm up against the guys from Anthrax and, you know, all the heavy bands. And really, it's, you know, you got to be a nice person. You got to firm handshake. You have to have a reputation that precedes you where it's like, okay, you're going to hire Rich. He's going to learn the song and he's going to come prepared. But then, you know, your best advertising is that word of mouth of like the guy showed up and he laid it down. You know what I mean? The band had fun. It was a great experience. Everybody had a great experience. All right, come back next year. So it definitely means a lot. Yeah, definitely to be accepted by your peers in multiple genres. And genres, you know, it's just a thing that it used to make it easier for people to put the right records in the right bin at Sound Warehouse or Tower Records. And now that we just have all the music of the world for $10 a month on Spotify, you know, when I get up in the morning, I'm a rock drummer. And my path in life was to be an overeducated rock drummer, which means I went back and I studied jazz and classical music, and I just kind of overeducated myself to be the most versatile musician I could be. But when I get up in the morning, I am a rock drummer, and I was meant to play large venues, and I stole that from, like, all my heroes, you know, like Liberty DeVito with Billy Joel for 30 years, and Kenny Aronoff with Mellencamp for 17 years, and it's like, I just stole from these guys. And you have to be careful, because you reap what you sow. I got exactly what I wanted in life. I was using these guys as a model. And now all these cats are my friends. They can text me. I could text them in the middle of the night, send them weird memes. So if you stay in the game, your heroes eventually become your colleagues. I mean, I'm sure you've done comedy shows where you're like, oh, my God, I'm opening up for Jeff Garlin, or this guy's following me. Oh, my God. And then you get to kibitz with these guys backstage. And so cool, you know, because you stayed in the game.
Now, how important is it to you? I know this. I remember when this, it popped up on one of my timelines. I know a modern drummer. Okay, you got the cover. Okay. Now, for is that what does that mean to a drummer? Because I interviewed Steve Smith from Journey, and he's done it like four or eight times. But he's
five covers just, or something.
He's nuts. Yeah. But what does that mean, and how did that come about? Because once again, you know, is that something you can pursue? Or is something where they come to you? Because you never want to be like, hey, put me on the cover. And people after a while go, like, shut up. But how did that come about?
I think you could pursue it. You could pursue it, like, if you're in the hot rock band at the time and you have a, like, super high-powered publicist, they can kind of lean on things. Like, say when the Black Crowes first record came out, I'm sure that publicist was, like, all over trying to get those guys on the cover of all their respective magazines. Or when the Killers came out, you know, with their first, you know, records, like, hey, let's get, you know... So that happens, but to me, I was pursuing it without pursuing it by taking the long road. And the long road was, once I started touring, I would share the information with MD. Hey, Rich Redman is on tour with such and such. Or I would say, hey, I just played on these three new records, and they put you in the little news section. Then occasionally you'd get a little half-page article, and then I started writing articles for them, like how-to articles, and then philosophical. You know, I did a five-part series on the crash concept and how people, drummers can use that to be more successful. Then I started writing articles on other drummers. So the folks at the magazine knew me well, and I had a relationship. So then they were just like, hey, man, let's do this. And then they assigned a writer to me, and I had a great time with him. We got together. Next thing you know, I'm 48 years old before my 50th birthday. And before, you know, the magazine is going almost all digital, like, because magazines are disappearing. Like, I'm on the cover of a physical magazine that may have been in the Barnes and Nobles. And that's just a childhood dream because, you know, as young kids, that's kind of our holy grail. Like, that magazine goes back to 1977, and I had every copy, physical copy. And then when I moved to Nashville, I was like, oh, my God, this is a lot of magazines. So I went down to Fork's Drum Closet, and I gave one of their star teachers there, I said, you could take all my magazines, and every time one of your kids shows up prepared or does a great job on preparing their lesson, give them a back issue of Modern Drummer and, you know, read and learn about the... Because this instrument's only 100 years old, really, and what moves the ball down the field is the people that make the music, that play the drums. So it is a super cool thing, you know, and of course you got to send the... framed copy to your mom and dad, and they got it at the floor of the house. And so when I go to see him at Christmas, I get to look at myself, you know, when I'm on the toilet, you know.
You're like, hey, there I am.
It's cool.
And you know? You should get a picture of you looking at your magazine, reading it as you're on the toilet. That would blow up the internet.
Hilarious. No, I'm very grateful for that opportunity. Yeah, very, very much so.
Now, you do a lot of drum clinics. And I noticed this about drummers, and I'm friends. I've interviewed a ton of great drummers. I mean, you, Kenny Jones from The Who, Simon Kirk, Steve Smith, Kelly Key.
Carmine.
You got me Liberty. You got me Carmine. You got me Liberty. It goes on. I'm like, wow, it's Jim McCarthy from the Yardbirds. I've interviewed a lot of drummers, and because of Spinal Tap, drummers have that attitude is a crazy one, you know, because they kept going through drummers. But what I've noticed is that most drummers have a real entrepreneurial spirit. I don't know if it's because you have to use both sides of your brain because, well, you're using your feet and your hands. We usually don't do that. Like, you have to use your hands for drumming and your feet for the hi-hat and all. So your whole, and sometimes drummers sing. You know, and
they're multitaskers, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think it is that makes, because all you guys, you know, Matt Starr, I mean, he's like, promotes all this shit, does speak, and you do speaking.
Yeah.
What do you think it is? It because you guys just get bored easy? It's because a lot of times, like with you, with Jason, you don't write the songs. Is it another stream of income? But why is it that every drummer I see, and you sell your sticks and your drum covers, what is it that makes you guys entrepreneurs? Because thousands of side hustles.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Yeah, look at Carmine. I mean, Carmine owns, his thing was properties. Guy's got a lot of properties, so he's got this, you know, money company. He did the great things with his Vanilla Fudge money and his King Cobra money, and he wrote one of the most successful drum books of all time, which was an amazing timing thing. You know, it's like he was the first, you know, non-buttoned up rock and roll drummer to write a drum method book. I think he sold 1 million copies, which is like unheard of. I don't know any drum book that sold 1 million copies. But yeah, I'm just a strong entrepreneur. It's like I look at my God-given ability and be like, look, at the first thing I want to do when I get up in the morning is bring people's songs to life, create energy, play arenas, play amphitheaters, play stadiums. But I also like to record. I also have a teacher's heart, and I love mentoring and like lifting up a future generation of people and sharing my information. And then I got into product design. I have my own signature drumsticks and drum pad, and I help design a bass drum beater for D-Dub. So we're always thinking. There's always cool. There's so many facets to the music business. For me, it was touring, recording, and education. I'm a big lover of music education. And around that, there's other things like doing live events. And so I created like almost like a one-man show. And I modify that for the audience at hand. It could be a college. It could be a five-star high school. It could be a big box music store like Sam Ash or Guitar Center. It could be a mom and pop drum shop, or, you know, I could modify that presentation and do a giant school assembly, or I can go and do, you know, Hewlett Packard, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, your big Fortune 100s. And it's all just about being able to communicate effectively, which I found that I have the gift of gab. You know, you and I hit it off right away. I was like, oh, I love this guy. We had a great conversation. So that's a God-given ability. And then you just figure out what can you do with those things. But yeah, drummers seem to have that. We have a community spirit. We lift each other up. And for the most part, you know, there might be some negative Nellies out there, but for the most part, we're very transparent, sincere people that really do try to lift up the drumming community, because we are in the dark. Sometimes we do get left behind. Sometimes we, many times, are not cut in on publishing and things like that. And so we have to roll up our sleeves and get a little bit more creative.
Where do you think that comes from? I know your mom's a teacher, right?
My mom is a nurse and my dad's an accountant. So they're both.
So where do you think that? Because I mean, that's a nurse is a job where you're not really an entrepreneur, and an accountant is, you know, an accountant, especially your dad's older. It's the old Bob Newhart button down accountant. But so where do you think the entrepreneurial spirit comes from for you? I mean, was there maybe a grandfather? Or I mean, because your mind works a lot. Where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, no, my grandparents were, man, they had those steady jobs. My grandfather put together, you know, rifles at Remington Arms, and he like fabricated tools and parts, and my grandmother worked at Schick, and they made the big razors and the big pens, and so she was like Lucy on the assembly line, you know what I mean, like, you know, doing that incredible. But for me, no, I had always had a paper route. I raked leaves, I shoveled snow, you know, I was a hustler, man, and thank God, I don't know, that was in my DNA, because you really have to have some hustle if you're going to do anything in the creative arts, because being good and being creative and being great at your instrument or your craft is an expectation. That's where you put in your tens of thousands of hours. But being able to market that and bring that to people and let people know you exist so you're hireable, I don't know. I just really, if I do something, I really go for it. I mean, after my a divorce at 45 years old, 46 years old, I was like, you know what? I want to try something in my midlife. I always wanted to try acting. So I go out to Los Angeles. I crash on your couch. And I'm driving around Toyota Yaris's, and I'm going to cold reading classes, and I'm going to Upright Citizens and doing my improv training, and I'm doing cartoon voiceover training and storytelling classes and TV hosting classes. I just wanted to see what I could do if I wasn't buried behind a set of drums. Not that it's negative. That's my great, it's an amazing calling in life, but I went for it, man. And I got myself into a couple horror films that were on Netflix, and I got to kick Christopher Maloney's butt, and I got stunt credit, and I had a CGI, animal on the Patton Oswalt did the voice of some little unicorn that was flying on me, you know, CGI stuff. I got my SAG card in under 5 years. I just had something to prove. I wanted to see if there was a place for me in that industry, and I'm still very curious about it. You know, like most actors, my job, last job, was many years ago. I get called for things, but sometimes I'm like, do I really want to be in an play drums in a garage in an antidepressant commercial? And I don't know. That's not really why I got into acting. I want to do like meaty things. So I just try to meet people that are, you know, where I can go around the casting director. Maybe I know somebody that wrote the story or somebody that's directing, and they go like, hey, we need doorman number 3. And it's like, well, I'll do it, you know? But you just have to be willing to just go for it in a major way and realize that it could happen, it could not happen, but you're going to find out if there's a place for you, you know?
Now, what made you decide to get into the motivational speaking and the speaking for businesses? Because when you think about it, I know you go out and you're with your drum set and you're wearing all black, and of course, and I run into a lot of, I always run into this, it always cracks me up, and on LinkedIn, and I always laugh because I know people who they're always like, we're a keynote speaker. We're a keynote. And I'm like, you know, Joanne had public speaker for because she speaks about sexual assault. I'm like, you have to change the keynote speaker, because I just got a message. She was on some show called, was when I discovered Idea, and someone's like, oh my God, the girl looks so familiar. And then all of a sudden at the end, they show a picture of you and her. And I said, sir. So I said, Joanne, you have 5 credits. You can say keynote speaker, but you actually are a keynote speaker. But what made you go into that? Because it's such a, everyone has a certain, and it's changing, but everyone has a certain thing of corporate, button down, you know, hey, kiss my ass, misogynistic world. And all of a sudden, some guy in all black with a drum set comes up. What? How did you get that idea, and how did you pursue it? Because that's, once again, there had to be a lot of rejection, because people were like, what the hell are you talking about? We're a pharmaceutical company. We don't, a drummer. But what made you decide to do that, and how was the early days? Was it hard?
Yeah, one company, I'm not for everyone. One company, I remember it was a German company. They made like laboratory equipment. So like, you know, talk about like a bull in a china shop. They were like, I don't know if you're right for us. You know what I mean? But you start to get more credits under your belt, and you're like, oh my God, he's done 13 speeches for Cisco, all the way from the 800 new hires at the Venetian Ballroom in Las Vegas to their top 20 performers at the top of the Ghost Bar at the Palms Hotel in Las Vegas. So you start to get these credits under your belt, and then, you know, how do you get your SAG card? Well, you need a job, but you can't have your job without the... So you start to get some credits together. People start to talk. You collect testimonials. You get in some on some bureaus, because that whole industry kind of works on bureaus, and I'm represented by a lot of bureaus, but a lot of times they don't champion you. Like, they just wait for somebody to pick from a roster of, well, okay, we can get the guy, the ex-president that played the saxophone, but this drummer dude, he's got a good message and he's much cheaper, you know? So some of it works like that, but most everything I do is human relationships and people that have witnessed something and they throw your name around. But I came up with that because I have a friend, Mark Schulman. He was a Kinks drummer for 13 years. We've been fast friends since 2002. And he was doing that about 8 years before me. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do the same thing. He's like, yeah, there's plenty of room in the industry for guys that play drums that are motivational speakers. And so he had his kind of like platform and program, and I came up with mine, the CRASH. It's the acronym thing. And some people love acronyms, some people hate acronyms, but it kind of just works for me. And it's a great way to have these 5 pillars, and most speeches are 1 hour in length. So I was like, all right, I'm going to come out. There's going to be an intro video instead of the guy that reads the Richard Edmund is a top call. You can't rely on a house MC, because a lot of times they are very non-charismatic people and they just bring the energy down instead. So I say, kill the lights. I got a 90-second video and it shows me playing on all the television shows and fire and lasers and stadiums. Gets everybody excited. Then I come running out, not walking out, and I don't have a lapel mic and there's no PowerPoint. I get out there, I play a hit song that they've heard on the radio. Then I start talking about these pillars, and it's a talk, play concept, which keeps everybody engaged because, let's face it, no one has an attention span. I think the attention span is 7 minutes these days. And so whether you've walked on the moon or you swam the English Channel, they're going to get pretty bored of you after 7 minutes. So the drums are loud. It's in our DNA as our first instrument. And I was just like, I'm going to just double down on this thing. So there's hit songs, there's takeaways, there's humor, there's storytelling, there's a lot of sweating, it's very visceral, it's interactive, and it's just right at 60 minutes. I rarely do anything above 60 minutes, which leaves people wanting more, and then I have three books if they want to buy the books, and you know, you speak to 500 dentists and they all go home with your book. Pretty cool, and they're all fired up to go home and hopefully take that energy that you're wearing on your sleeve and put it into people's mouths.
Now, you're going to be touring again. You're going on tour again. Now, how much did you miss touring during the pandemic? Because once again, you know, you've always said, get up, take my bags, I go, my sticks, I go where I got to go. That's my life. You know, with relationships, yep. You got to live with it, but this is my life. And Mick Mars sort of said that yesterday. He said how there's some regret. He had some things to regret, but in the same thing, he did it. And he said, and this was number one. Doing, playing guitar. I want to be a flash showman. I wanted to be that level. So how much did you miss it? Because when you're doing something, and you've been doing it forever, and you've been touring, it's not like you're sitting there playing in a, as you said, a wedding band or in a bar. You're playing with the Flames, and you're playing venues, Madison Square Garden, Fenway. You know, I know you went to Australia and did some big show. I mean, you play, you know, you're with one of the biggest country stars in the world. So you're used to that. Was there any depression that set on you when you weren't going out on the road? Because it has to be so stimulating when you go, maybe two nights, but I'm going to just destroy and have an experience that maybe 1,000 people in the world have. Yeah. I mean, what was it like for you during the pandemic?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, we would check in with each other like once a week or twice a month, and we'd have our little Zoom happy hours, and we'd pour ourselves an old-fashioned or something, and that was great. And, you know, of course, you know, you were on the East Coast, I was in California, and you know how it is when that sun sets in California, you got that cotton candy sunset, right? And you get into the habit of like drinking coffee in the morning, and then you pass the baton at 4 o'clock, and you have a glass of red wine, and then you light up a cigar. And so there was some nice smelling the roses moments, but when you do something 3 to 4 times a week, year after year, and you don't do it for a year and a half, it is definitely going to mess with you physically, emotionally. Oh my God. Yeah. Just the rug was ripped out from under our feet. And then there was this fear of this thing. Are we going to have to eat each other? Where are we going to get our toilet paper from? Like, it was all very confusing, but you know, I like to fill my time. So I would just stare into this little green light on my Macintosh computer for a year and a half. I taught at the New School in New York. I taught at Musicians Institute in Hollywood. I did private lessons via Zoom. And then I did took acting classes with Leslie Kahn there in Hollywood on via Zoom, which is very, very challenging because you have to kind of like try to frame it and look at the person looking at the camera, and then occasionally you could make it look like you could tape some of your sides up on the side of the computer and make it look like you had it memorized. It was tough, but I just and then a lot of exercise. Oh my God, I ran all over every square inch of West Hollywood and Beverly Hills. I could tell you where every little thing is, and I overdid it because I ended up tearing my meniscus because I was running 7-8 miles a day. I was thin, man, really, really thin. But the thing is I was trying to take care of my body, trying to take care of my mind. So when the call came, hey, the world is back, we can go back and we can do this again, I was ready. Because if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. So I was just trying to stay busy, move some skill sets down the field, and then just stay ready, like with my skill set and my body. So we went back pretty early. I mean, a lot earlier than a lot of bands. So there was some anxiety around that, you know, but we did it. Now here we are halfway through 2024, man. It's a great, great thing. Like I said, when you don't see the people in your life, we used to do 220 shows a year, and then 200, and then 180, and then 160, and then couple of years of 125, and then 8 years of 80 shows a year, and now we're at the point where we just do maybe 50, 60 shows a year, which is very, very manageable. But like I said, when you take that away from somebody, it's very confusing.
Does it get tiresome at all? You know, because it is, I mean, you told me before when they put like a Fitbit on you or something, when you drum, you had like some heart rate of an athlete. And it is, drummers, it's excruciating work because you are, just you're moving your arms, your legs. I mean, just think there's that machine at the gym where I always see the old guys where they run they do their arms. It's always in front of the treadmill. And I'm like, I said to Joanne, I said, what are they doing? She goes, it's for your arms. I said, maybe I should do that because I'm getting orangutan boobs. And maybe I should, you know, do that. But do you ever get tired of it? Like, is it just as soon as the you hear, boom, ladies and gentlemen, Jason Aldean, then just boom.
Yeah, it's like Pavlov's dog, man. You're just in it. And there's all these like systems and processes of being on the road and knowing how to create energy and conserve energy. And there's a lot of, you know, you have to treat yourself like an athlete. You know, I do my flexibility, my mobility training. I got a little mobile gym under the bus, and I got the Bowflex weights that'll go from 5 to 50 pounds. And we got, all the bands and yoga mats and the stuff so you can stay engaged. And then I'll use the amphitheater as kind of like a gym, almost like parkour, where you could run the grass up and down. You could do speed sprints. You could just hike back and forth, listening to podcasts and stuff. So just staying active and moving, but you also can't do it too much because then at night you got to burn 1,000 calories. And sometimes I will get caught with my pants down just a little bit where you're like, okay, it's a 90-minute show, and about minute 75, like some of the most intense songs are the last song. So you have to be like, my drum tech, John, would be like, I could tell you were starting to fade a little bit there. I was like, yeah, bro, but I'm going to be 54 years old. You're 31. You know, I said, I'm doing a pretty good job. I'm a youthful rock drummer up there in the body of a middle-aged man. So, but the thing is, it's just so fun and it's so physical and there's so much going on. You're thinking about your time and your groove and your feel and your technique and the tuning of the drums and getting a consistent sound and then leading and following at the same time and then making sure that I'm lifting up the guys in the band and I'm reading their cues. There's a lot going on. You're like a psychologist and a trainer and a musician and you're directing traffic. A lot going on up there. But it's so incredible. And then when you do it, it's like you check the box again. Like, oh, we changed these people's lives. They came out. They paid $20, $30 to park. They're paying $20 for a mixed drink. Their babysitter is $25 an hour. I mean, they bought that expensive ticket. We have a massive responsibility to these people, man. And it starts and stops with the drums, man. The drummer sets the tone and the energy of any band. And a good drummer can take an average band and just lift them to the heavens. And a mediocre to bad drummer can take an incredible band and sink them like the Titanic.
Do you think you'll ever leave? Do you think you'll ever, like, are you one of these people like, I'll die with a guitar, I'll die, they'll be prying the dead stick out of my rigor mortis body, I'll have a drumstick and I'll go pull. Do you see ever leaving the music business?
No, absolutely not. That's totally my calling in life. Of course, I have other creative interests, and I'm a good teacher, and I have that entrepreneurial spirit. So for some reason, something physically happened where I wouldn't be able to play as loud or athletically. There's always that cool, you know, jazz trio, and there's always the little cool top 40 band, or there's always the little tribute band, or the, you know, wedding band drummers are some of the best drummers on the planet because you have to play music all the way from the birth of jazz to the British invasion to new wave to metal to the chicken dance to an R&B ballad to Iggy Azalea and Motown. That's a lot of stuff. It's very satisfying. I like playing all those different styles. So if I have to modify the way I'm doing things, I'm still going to be touring, recording, playing on a local level, and educating. And that's good. That's I sleep well at night knowing that there's always going to be some sort of an outlet for me in the music business, but I want to keep playing at the highest of levels and playing physically like I am, which is why it's so important nowadays to put the heavy objects over my head, to work the heart, to do the stretching, ice, you know, really high grade vitamins. I take my AG1 every day. You know, you've got your certain protein bars. You got to have, you watch your diet. You got to make sure you're hydrated. It's like you really have to treat yourself like an athlete.
One final question. Looking back at your career, you've had a great career. You can answer like one or two things on this. What are some of the things that have made you the proudest? That make you proud at the end of the day? You go, man, this makes me proud. What is something that is that? What is that for you?
Yeah. Steve, you know, I tell you, you're such a great interviewer. But I've probably done six of these things with you, and you always have great questions. I don't even know if you write these things down. You're in the flow.
I ad-lib everything.
The flow, which is great, because that's almost like your Sudoku or your crossword puzzle, because you're firing all these neurons constantly, like once or twice a week. I'm proud about so many things. I'm so grateful for having parents that saw something in me that supported me emotionally and financially, for like, hey, let's get this kid drum lessons. Hey, let's get this kid to college. Hey, let's make sure he's got some great gear. Hey, let's help him out when he's starving in Nashville and eating ramen noodle and maxing out his credit cards. And so to be able to have them come out to shows or see me play New Year's Rockin' Eve or see me in music videos, they're like, my son, he did it. So my parents are so proud, and I'm proud that they're proud. And I was happy that I could show them, like, hey, I'm going to do this and actually make it happen. Being a person of character and integrity and follow through, and you make something happen. And it is not normal. It's just the fact that I can navigate this crazy business and make something happen. It is not a get a degree, get a job, 401k, benefits, retire at 65 on the nose. It is not that at all. But, you know, when I moved to Nashville, my goal was, I wrote it down. I had a purpose statement, and that was, my purpose in life is to affect people in a positive way and change their lives. And I know I could do that creatively through everything that I do, whether it be education or entertainment. My goal in life was to hear myself on the radio, see myself on television, and travel the world on someone else's dime. And so I'm proud that I was able to do that. And then to see all these wonderful venues. I mean, we were just in Pittsburgh the other day. We were playing an acoustic show, doing a grand opening of Jason's third location of his restaurant and bar and grill. And the restaurant and bar and grill was right across the street from PNC Park. And my friend Jack, who's been in the band for, like, he's the new guy, 14 years, he goes, Redman, you remember when we played that in 2015? I said, we played there. He goes, yeah, dude, PNC Park right there. And now we're playing the restaurant across the street with our acoustic guitars. It's just an incredible, just all the experiences, going to, you know, 19 different countries and playing for, you know, the military early in my career, and then just being able to hear yourself on the radio. But really, another thing I really like is, just because I love education, I've been able to mentor a lot of kids that are going on to get gigs in the music business, or they're getting accepted to the music college, or graduating from the music college, or they're doing the thing. And so for whatever reason, I was visible, so they looked up to me, and I was approachable enough to say, hey kid, come with me, and I'm show them a couple things. And as we that's really our purpose in life, is to share our gift with other people. And I've been able to help other people's dreams come to fruition. So probably that is the most important thing, is seeing all of my students and friends and colleagues go on to live a life of their dreams because of whatever influence we have on them. Pretty cool.
Well, there you go. So now, how can people get in touch with you, Rich? I know your website, richredman.com. It's a multimedia feast for your eyes. That's what you're saying.
You are funny. Yeah, that's pretty easy. That's kind of a hub for all things, richredman.com. It's REDMOND.com. And of course, it's just my name on the YouTubes and the Instagrams and the Facebooks, and, you know, so I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. And I told myself that if I ever had a time in life where I was going to have some notoriety, I would get back with people immediately. And so that's usually what I hear from people. God, you got back to me so fast. And I think that's a great, you know, as you know, do a lot of business networking. That is a great tactic and technique for edging out the competition, and then cultivating, hopefully, lifelong relationships.
So people, go check out Rich's website. Check out my site. Actually, you're probably listening to this on my site, but if you're listening to it on some other platform, or indie rock in Canada, or Indy 100 in Las Vegas, you go to my website, and I can say, now, there's Rich's 1,001 episodes. Before, I was waiting, and it was so much pressure to get that last guest, and I got him, and now I'm like, screw it. You know, I did a lot more than most podcasts have. So go to that. You can email me, cooper@coopertalk.net. You can find me on Twitter. It's @CooperTalk. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.